Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. I'm so glad you're joining me today. We have got one great show for you. And I'm here in the Progressive Radio Network studio, and I'm looking at the beautiful blue eyes of John Joseph, my guest. They are blue, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Very blue.
Very blue. And I'm really excited to have him here and to speak with him. We're here to talk about the re-release of his book, The Evolution of a Cro-Magnon, where he recounts his hard times and spiritual redemption in this autobiography, A Traumatic Childhood. That is a gentle way to put your story, John. In foster homes, just the beginning of John's evolution. He fronted one of the most important bands in the underground punk scene, the Cro-Mags, as well as Blood Clot. And he faced homelessness, addiction, betrayal, and insanity. And today, in 2017, he is one awesome specimen of a man. And I am very happy to know you, John Joseph.
Same
Welcome
here.
To It's All About Food.
And thank you for having me back. It's been about
seven years. Yep.
Jesus.
So you were last here.
Might I say that you've aged like a fine wine? You look great there.
Thank you. You know,
and that's coming from a sober person.
I wanted to say, my birthday is this Saturday. It's Earth Day, my birthday.
Beautiful.
I will be 59, and I'm 4 years older than you.
Wow.
And I want to talk a little bit about that, because we were growing up in the same scene, in some of the same places, and when I read your book,
Did it bring back memories?
It brought back memories, and your book is... I mean, there are no words. I was just heartbroken through the whole scene that we live in a world that is so cruel.
Yeah. And I just gave the book to someone else, and a friend of mine, and she said, I can't believe the stuff that foster family did to you. And I said, listen, there's people out there doing a lot worse stuff to kids. I've heard, because I work with kids who are incarcerated.
Yep.
And I go to prisons and I speak and go to high schools and, you know, lockups. And I get a chance to mentor these kids. And, I mean, the stuff that I went through, as crazy as it was and messed up, there's a lot worse stuff that goes on to kids nowadays. You know,
when I read that, because you say that a number of times, that what you went through isn't as bad as what you've heard other people have gone through, is just mind-boggling. I mean, you talk about your foster mom in this one situation where you were fed what you called the spit Oreo on white
spit
bread.
Sandwiches.
This show is called It's All About Food, so I like to bring up the food items, but she would scrape the cream off with her mouth.
With her teeth, and she didn't like the cream. She just liked the wafer, so she would spit it in a bowl.
And that was your bread.
And then whatever moldy bread was laying in the bottom of the bread drawer, she would put it on that. And that's what we got fed every single day with tea. And that was it. And they fed us the same food as they did the dog at the same time to show us where we fell on the food chain and how insignificant. I mean, the whole time we were there for almost 7 years, they just tried to make us feel insignificant and worthless. And they told us constantly, nobody else wants you. You're lucky to be here. I mean, even that stuff of taking me to the nut house and saying, if I open my mouth, this is where I'm going to end up, and no one's ever going to know you're there. And
you wrote about Pilgrim State.
Pilgrim State. Yeah. That's, I mean, you know, people wonder how come kids keep quiet. They put the fear of God into you. And that's why and the other thing was, my mother was suicidal. We went home on one visit, and she tried to cut her wrist and take a bunch of pills, and we had to call my uncle because we asked when we were coming home. And she flipped out. So we knew not to say anything, because if she has another nervous breakdown, we're never going to come home. So that's where that whole diary came in. And we hid this diary. My brother came up with the idea to just write down everything that they did to us. I mean, when we finally left that home, the social worker broke down crying.
Sure.
And the thing was, you know, I always say people that hustle on the streets, if you look at the history, it's you're not born that way.
Mm-hmm.
You do that as a result because the human instinct is to survive. So whatever we had to do to eat, and there's humorous moments even in the form, mm-hmm. like, you know, they were taking us and they're like, you know, how the hell are these kids gaining weight? Like, but we were stealing. We found out where they kept the money because that's what they were doing it for. They had six kids and getting $300 a month for care, clothing. Clothing, we had to just wear stuff till it fell off and then go back to the poor box and pick out more clothes. They never bought us clothes.
Mm-hmm.
We never got clothes the entire time we were there. We were never allowed in the refrigerator the entire time we were there. They kept us in a garage, sleeping on cots and this dirty den and had to sit out in the patio in the freezing cold. Christmas time, you'd be hearing them celebrating and we're out there, you know. So it was a lot of stuff to deal with, but it was the humor that got us through. And then the fact that we were able to start getting over on them. But even when we stole money from them, we basically ate just enough, but we always bought my mother gifts thinking, mm-hmm. like, if we buy her this,
yep.
you know, we bought her art, and I stole a fish tank one time out of a damn aquarium, like a 25-gallon fish tank running down the street with it because she said she wanted a fish
yep.
tank, and it was calming.
Right.
I mean, and then we had to hide it until we got, like, hide it in the woods until, you know, her boyfriend who didn't want us around.
Yeah.
I won't say what we were doing, but they have a term for that, you know, when we're getting in the way of his sex life.
Sure. Yep.
So that's why he didn't want us around. And
now ultimately you were there for him and his demise later
on. You see that?
Yep.
Because that was the arc of the growth. I mean, that, her telling me, you know, us, you know, we've become a lot closer since the release of the book and all of this stuff. That went on because
your mother did terrible things, but you now understand
why she was going through.
Why
she went through. My father raped her twice, and that's how me and my younger brother were born. We didn't know that. She didn't tell me that till I was 40. And even that moment was so powerful because I just kept hurling hurtful things at her because she let that man move into the house that I got when her husband gambled away the house behind her back, and then was he was a recovering alcoholic. He was in AA, but he became a gambling addict and gambled the house away. So when they went and he was hitting her, had I known that, I would have beat the crap out of him after what my father did to my mother. She never told us. And then when they went to get divorced, she had nothing because mm-hmm. he gambled away the house. And then I was doing good at the time. I signed a record deal and all this other stuff. So I go in and I get her an apartment. I mean, she left with nothing, like her clothes in boxes. I had to buy a furniture, a TV, get her an apartment, all of that. And then she turns around and tells me, I got to tell you something. The man who didn't want you around, who you were abused for 7 years, I let him move in. That's when it hit the fan. And it was just, and since she told me her side of the story and the book and all this stuff that's gone down, and I was there for her. And then when he passed away from cancer, you know, he sat on my stoop, and he was a big guy. He worked for Con Ed. He was one of these burly Con Ed dudes. He was down to about 115, 120 pounds, dying of cancer, and sat on. This was my mother never put him in a hospice. She took care of him, and this was right before he went into the hospital, maybe a week before he sat on my stoop with tears in his eyes and asked for me to forgive him, and I did. And then when he was in the hospital, I went and put holy water on him and played all this stuff to help him transition to the next life, but. Through all of this whole ordeal, we've become a lot closer. But that foster home and it developed a lot of food. You know, thank God that I found And you know what? It was Gary Noel listening to him in 80 and 81 in a squat, and I wrote about that in the book. Like
on a little radio.
I think it was BAI or something, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. And I listened to him on this little transistor radio. No windows, no plumbing. Dangerous gang dudes trying to come in and take the building from us. And by candlelight. And I sat there taking notes from the stuff I learned from Gary Noel. So that's why when I came in, I was like, oh, man, is he here? I want to meet him and tell him, you know, how much he's affected my life from back in the day. But thankfully, I found a healthy way to eat because I've had food issues, you know, because of being starved as a kid. I always thought the food was going to run out and I would overeat and all of this stuff. But now it's kind of like I've learned through training for Ironman and diet and all this stuff and writing books and being around guys like Rich Roll and Brendan Braziers of the world.
We love them.
Yeah, they're next level studs. You know?
I just want to say that this book, The Evolution of a Cro-Magnon,
Cro-Magnon,
is just an incredible story. And anyone who is complaining about anything in their life, when you read this book, you're going to shut up because you have been through so much that, most people can't even imagine anything like that happening to them. But the most amazing thing is that your heart has stayed open and you are an incredibly good person, and you've been through hell and back, and now you're making so many amazing choices. You're on a healthy vegan diet. You're fit.
Organic.
Awesome. And I just don't understand how you've managed to rise above. And that's...
I got three letters for you.
Yeah.
And I tattooed them on my leg, and I learned it from the Bad Brains in 1980. And it's called PMA, Positive Mental Attitude. That's the next book I'm almost done with right now. I've been working on it for about 2.5 years about PMA. And at the time, I came out of jail because if we fast forward, I was on the streets for almost 2 years, and then I got incarcerated. I was in some of the worst places. A juvenile at 16 could go. I was in Spofford in 78. I spent my 16th birthday there. And then I went upstate for 18 months, 3 months in Spofford, got stabbed in Spofford, fighting every day, upstate in Lincolndale. And then I came out and I got arrested again. And at the time, my mother had been seeing or knew or dated this Navy recruiter and offered me the Navy, as opposed to possibly facing more jail time. So as I always say, and my brother E says, the state didn't raise no fool. We took the Navy, and he got in trouble again. My brother was locked up with me in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were both on the street. Because at a certain time, we said, you know what? We've went down this road, and we tried to let New York State handle our business and take care of us. And they failed miserably because they never investigated that home. Then they put us in these crazy boys' homes and all these other messed up families, except for the McGowans, who were cool in Garden mm-hmm. City. But at that point, we were damaged goods. So they got rid of us quick. And then we just said, you know what? We'll take our chances on the streets of New York. And come on, the streets of New York, 76, 77.
Yeah, I remember you writing about that.
Yeah, it ain't no joke. And
I mean, I was a good little girl going to New York City to see theater when I was in junior high school in the 70s.
Yeah.
And 8th Avenue was a scary place.
I mean, we called it the Deuce back then. It wasn't even called Times Square. And I seen people get stabbed, shot. I mean, personally, I got shot with a .22 in a drug deal. But after coming out of lockup and getting rearrested, I took the Navy. I went to boot camp. We were at Fort Hamilton, ready to ship out, January 3rd, 1980. And my brother said, hey, I know a place right down the block that sells angel dust. We went and bought, I think it was 4 or 5 bags of angel dust. We went to boot camp dusted on angel dust. I'd never been on an airplane before. Mm. I went on an airplane high on angel dust and then went to boot camp and woke up and I was like, where am I? But I was in great shape because when I was locked up, I boxed, I lifted weights. In lockup, one of the terms they say is you got to get your weight up. I went into lockup 130 pounds soaking wet. I came out 165-pound beast that trained all the time, played sports, boxed. So I was definitely, and I had this anger issue. But mm-hmm. the thing was, even in the Navy, I was smuggling drugs. I was dealing drugs. I was selling acid. I caught a drug case in Norfolk, Virginia. And then I met the Bad Brains. And they had just started getting into Rastafari. And that was the major turning point of my life. And that's, the singer had read Napoleon Hill's books, Think and Grow Rich or whatever, mm-hmm. talking all about PMA and all this stuff. And he put it into his lyrics. He had this song called Attitude. And it was like blitz speed punk rock. And then I just took to that. I ended up, you know, the psychiatrist that they had me seeing in the Navy said I was a time bomb waiting to go off. Mm-hmm. And I did. I exploded on this guy and beat him with paint cans. And then, you know, the whole thing, I was facing going to Leavenworth and I, because of the drug case and then beating this guy on my ship. They had to medevac me by helicopter off the ship in the middle of the friggin' Caribbean on the way to Brazil, back to Puerto Rico. Just every chain of event was like the universe, God, Krishna, whatever, was just laying everything out for me to make this change. And like if I didn't get the infection in my wisdom tooth and have to go to the hospital, like, you know, it was just crazy how everything kept happening. And then I got a hold of, so I split from the Navy and went back and fought these Puerto Ricans in this gang. Crazy stuff. You can't make it up.
Yeah, the book is over 400 pages.
Yeah,
I mean,
my uncle was like, you know, this is like a lethal weapon. You can kill somebody with this book. It's like, he didn't expect, like...
But what I love about it, and you're jumping around all these things, and you can't get the drama or the intensity unless you read the entire story.
It's taken out of context.
I'm still blown away by this happy ending or this happy beginning.
Well, you know what it was? It was getting into A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami's books, Bhagavad Gita As It Is, and starting to get into yoga and meditation. The Bad Brains, the main thing they told me was you could work with us after I got in this fight, this chain fight. I had a chain and these guys were trying to kill me with knives and I got stabbed in the shoulder, but I fought them and I gained respect on the street. I knew that in lockup. You don't let people do things to you. You know, after what happened to me as a kid, what these people did to me and these other kids did to me in this home, I said, nobody's ever putting their hands on me again. I learned how to defend myself. And you know, that's this out of respect. These Puerto Rican gang members were like, and they were they had the number one heroin and cocaine spot in America down in the Lower East Side. And they were like, yo, you're the only one that ever stood up to us. Respect. And then the Bad Brains gave me a job, but the main thing they said was, you could come on a road with us, but you have to eat Itau, meaning pure plant-based. Mm. You can't take drugs and you can't drink. And I said, you know what? You could have told me to worship Skittles and I would because I love the band. But thankfully, and their sound man was a raw foodist who was into Victorious Kovinskis. I met him. I went to see Victorious speak at Integral Yoga Institute.
Right.
Because I worked at Prana Foods. They got me a job in a health food store. I started educating myself. And the catalyst for change was when I stopped eating meat, all of those anger issues subsided.
Wow.
And this, like, amazing aura just kicked in. And I started being like, yo, like, I just, for the first time in my life, I felt peaceful because I just read this quote the other day. When you eat an animal, you're eating every single second of tortured time that that animal has had in its life. You're ingesting that. That's affecting your consciousness. Even Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, all these Vedic teachings say the same thing. You're ingesting the karma of that animal. And when I stopped eating meat and I went on this like raw food diet at first, I was like, wow, the change was just like so dramatic. It was crazy. I started, then I got into yoga, martial arts, the whole world of higher consciousness just opened up. Then I started chanting Hare Krishna. I lived as a monk for 2 years. and although the leaders after Prabhupada left the planet did a bunch of crazy stuff too. So that was even some next. And you read the book, so you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, it's resiliency. That's what this whole trip has taught me, is resiliency and flexibility. You know, you have to fight through things in life. And that's, you know, that's the code of the warrior, is never quit. You never quit. You never surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they drill. Like my boy's in Navy, you know, my boy's an active duty Navy SEAL. I just met him and his kid. He's a team leader too, which means he's responsible for other guys that they make it home alive.
Mm.
And he's one of the most resilient, like never panics in situation. I've learned a lot just from watching what he's been able to do in the last 16, 17 years of his Navy career. And, you know, he took me, he was one of the stars of Act of Valor. So he takes me to the Intrepid for the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these, like, Marcus Sutrell, all these SEAL Team 6 guys, like the baddest of the bad. And he's like, this guy, I used to go on the road with him. He used to take me to the yoga spots. And they're like, what? Like, you know, but he's, you learn a lot. And that's why I try to surround myself by A-type personalities, because I'm trying to learn. I still have a lot to learn.
Wait, we all do. That's what life's about, learning. But I think you are an important messenger for a specific group of people who can understand you and hear you, because you speak their language and you've been through the hell that they've been through. And then you couple that with this open heart. So I imagine you're of great help and provide a lot of hope to the kids that...
Well,
you do work with, mentor at-risk incarcerated
100%.
Youths.
I just was at Goshenanics, Maximum
Because,
Security.
You know, if I went there, nobody would look at me
and
listen to me.
You know what? Here's the whole thing. And I'm going to tell you, because I think it was like 6 or 7 years ago, I spoke at the first high school. It was in East New York. All like gang members, Crips, Bloods, whatever. Am I allowed to curse?
You can say whatever you want.
Oh, all right. I didn't know that. Now we're getting off the rated G shit. Here we go. I'm going to tell you exactly what they said. So I walk in, and it was wintertime. I had a coat on. And it's all... So the English teacher read my book. She's like, I would like you to come to these kids because they're all starting to get in trouble. As soon as I walked in, I heard the rumbling. Who does this white motherfucker think he is trying to come here and tell me some shit? What the fuck does he know? So as soon as I got to the library and I started breaking down my story and then telling them what I went through, I had their complete undivided attention. And then I broke out my passport and I started showing them. Look where I've been all over the world. You know where all the guys that's locked up and... went through all the stuff that I did. I said, they're either in jail, they're drug addicts, or they're dead.
That's
I said,
about it.
You're at a point right now in your life where every decision is going to be very, very crucial to how you're going to live your future. And even when these kids are locked up, I met these kids doing 8-10 years in Goshen. They were already sentenced. And I said, look, it's never too late to change, man. You work on yourself when you're inside and you be a better person. You know, you follow the rules. You're going to get out. You're only, whatever, 16, 17 years old. You know, you're still going to have part of your life there.
And that's a universal message.
The other thing is, I just did an interview with my friend who writes for Psychology Today and Huffington Post. And he's, you know, and he's a psychiatrist. He said, you have more effect on these kids than anybody with a degree. Mm-hmm. Because you know what? I walked in their shoes. That's what they're looking. They could care less if you got a PhD. That don't mean shit to them. What means something to them is I understand what they're going through. And that's why I work with these kids. And I get these kids to change their diet and do all this other stuff. I give them books, you know, on...
We just have a few minutes left.
Yeah, okay.
I can't believe the time just flies.
That's what happens when you're having
that's
fun. That's what they say. The time flies.
I want to talk about your other book, Meat is for Pussies, which...
Thank you for saying the title. Some people don't want to say
it. I have no problem saying it, and I think it's an important book. Now, you had first published it, and then HarperCollins came out and published
it. Picked it up.
You were telling me earlier that you had some challenges with that, because a lot of people take offense to the title. But what's important about it, again, is you coming from where you came from and the language that you use in the book is a certain group of people are going to relate to you, your language, and your message and hear it and then take positive action.
Right. Well, oddly enough, most of the people that bought that book were women who bought it for their dudes. And I've received thousands and thousands of emails since that book first came out in 2010 and then was reissued from dudes saying, yo, thank you for writing this book because none of these wackadoo vegans were ever getting through to me. The way you put it and the vernacular, that the way you talk, dude, it just the light came on. I said, bro, that's the way I learned it. I learned it from guys like HR from the Bad Brains and Daryl and Doc and J.W. Lee, who produced their album. I mean, you know, and I, honestly, this guy just got a write-up in GQ magazine. He's the world's, he's a vegan bodyguard, and he's one of the biggest, he's Justin Bieber's bodyguard in Australia.
Oh,
my friend Ian Norrington.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 6'3", 240 pounds, like Muay Thai fighter. And he went on tour with me. I was training for my first Ironman at the time. So everybody else was getting shit-faced and drunk, living the rock and roll fantasy bullshit life. I'm getting up at fucking 5 o'clock in the morning after playing, going for runs, swims, hitting the gym. And he's like, bro, how the fuck are you doing it, man? And I had a copy of my book, Meat is for Pussies. I gave it to him. By the end of the tour, he stopped eating meat, and he's never looked
back.
He even got vegan tattooed on the inside of his lip. When you pull the lip down, it says vegan. But that's the... And then he's gone. He has, like, Hell's Angels working for him in Australia with his prior company, Special Forces guy. He turned around and got all them to go plant-based. So it's a grassroots movement. You're not going to hear this information in the mainstream.
No, but you're going to hear it here at Progressive Radio Network.
That's right. With Karen Harkless and John Bloodclaw Joseph.
John, thank you for coming and thank you for joining me. And I love you.
Yo, you rock. You're the rock star.
Woo! Okay, thank you.
And say hello to Gary Noel for me. Tell him John Bloodclaw loves him.
I will do that.
All right.
Okay, thank you so
much. Wow, thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk about the reducitarian solution.